Welcome to the U.S. Institute of Peace for this event on peacekeeping in Darfur. I think there's general recognition that the AU peacekeeping force in Darfur has handled themselves with courage and usually with competence, but there's also agreement that the conditions are very difficult, that the force is undermanned, probably need at least twice as many as are currently deployed, that the mandate is very restricted, that there's insufficient logistical support for their operations. They confront a lack of support and cooperation from the government of Sudan, and there's inadequate backstopping and coordination from AU headquarters in Addis Ababa. The question is, what should be done? Can the AU, with international support, remedy the deficiencies of its current operation? Can NATO make up for the logistical and training deficits? The Bush administration has talked about transferring the peacekeeping to a UN force. Kofi Annan has publicly declared his support for this transfer. But the government of Sudan has opposed this, and on Friday, the African Union had a meeting and made a decision about this that both of our speakers today will address. We're very pleased to have two presenters today who are very familiar with these issues. Our first speaker will be Sally Booker, who is a longtime analyst and advocate relating to African affairs, currently executive director of Africa Action. Previously, Sally directed the Council on Foreign Relations African Studies program, served as a professional staff member in the Africa subcommittee in the House, and served as a program officer for the Ford Foundation in Eastern and Southern Africa. And just today it was announced that in May he will become Executive Director of Global Rights. Our second presenter is Ambassador Kadir Ahmed. He's a career official of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He has served as ambassador and in other positions in Sudanese embassies in various parts of the world, and currently is head of mission of the Embassy of Sudan here in Washington. I'll call on Sally to start us off.
Thank you. Should I come up there, David?
Please, yeah.
Well, let me begin by thanking David and the U.S. Institute for Peace for organizing this discussion this afternoon. I regret that there's not a Darfuri representative on the panel, but I want to make clear that Africa Action doesn't presume to speak on behalf of the people of Darfur, but rather in solidarity with the women, the men, and the children of Darfur, and on behalf of millions of Americans that care deeply about ending the violence that is going on there. So the first question is, why are we discussing peacekeeping in Darfur in the first place right now? And it's largely because, as Jan Eglin of the United Nations has said, this year, 2006, very much looks like we're returning to 2004, when Darfur really represented the killing fields of the world, or hell on earth, as Secretary General Kofi Annan referred to the situation then. There's increasing violence and a decreasing ability to provide humanitarian relief. Those are the proximate reasons why we're focusing on a discussion of peacekeeping in Darfur right now. But we need to be clear that we're having this discussion because of the crimes committed by the government of Sudan as part of a counterinsurgency strategy pursued by the government of Sudan against rebel groups in Darfur since 2003. These crimes committed by the government of Sudan include genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes, and they have been committed on a massive scale, and they continue to be committed. Darfur is often referred to as the world's greatest humanitarian disaster in the world today, but it is a man-made disaster. It is a disaster that is the consequence of specific political and military decisions made by Khartoum. So at this present date, we have a death toll in Darfur surpassing 400,000 people. Half of that number have been killed in direct acts of violence by the government, military, police, air force, as well as its allied militias, collectively known as the Janjaweed. Half of that total number have died because of the conditions created in the course of this genocide, the conditions in the camps for the internally displaced people. And there are nearly now 3 million internally displaced people. These are people whose homes have been destroyed, whose entire family assets have been destroyed, who are herded into camps with inadequate food, shelter, medicine, and creating conditions whereby they continue to die at an alarming rate. And of course, there are some additional 200,000 to 300,000 Darfuri refugees who have fled the violence across the border into Chad. This process of genocide and war crimes has also constituted or been constituted by tens of thousands of rapes and other gender-based sexual violence against women and girls. So that's why we're discussing peacekeeping, because of these massive crimes against humanity committed by the government of Sudan. And so what is the purpose of peacekeeping in Darfur? Well, the number one priority obviously must be the protection of the people of Darfur. Other objectives are important, such as accountability, that is, accountability for these crimes that have been committed, facilitating the delivery of humanitarian aid, and of course political negotiations as well between the government and Darfur rebels. But all of these other objectives are subsidiary to that of the need for protection and for security for the people of Darfur. So the peacekeeping objectives must be first and foremost to stop the killing, the rape, the continued displacement of civilians. Secondly, it's to provide security to facilitate the delivery of humanitarian relief. A number of humanitarian aid agencies have had to withdraw from Darfur during the period of this violence, and others are currently stating that they may not be able to stay if security conditions continue to deteriorate. Thirdly, the role of peacekeeping would be to create a secure environment by enforcing the African Union negotiated ceasefire in order to help focus the political negotiations on political solutions by removing the opportunity for the parties to pursue their ends militarily on the ground. And finally, the purpose of such a peacekeeping force must be to facilitate the return of the millions of Darfuri people who have been rendered homeless and who are now internally displaced. Not just to facilitate their return, but to facilitate the reconstruction of their homes, the reconstruction of their livelihoods, their culture, indeed their identity. And so before talking about what the AU has accomplished, first we need to make clear that the government of Sudan cannot be the vehicle for providing security or protection to the people of Darfur, obviously because they are the authors of the crimes that have been committed against the people of Darfur that have resulted in this greatest of the world's humanitarian disasters today. Genocide is a unique crime against humanity and therefore requires unique solutions. You cannot count on the normal forces of security or law and order, the military, the police, the local legal system, and the courts to address the situation when, in fact, it is the government that has both the intent and the actions to destroy particular communities on the basis of their ethnicity, identity, race, or nationality. And so this, of course, early on rendered the government of Sudan as obviously the inappropriate vehicle for providing any security to the people of Darfur. The African Union, to its credit, only 2 years old in 2004 when it negotiated a ceasefire between the government and the rebels, has been the regional organization that has committed the most to try and ending the violence in Darfur. It negotiated the ceasefire and established a small ceasefire observer mission with a protection force, but a protection force only to protect the observers, not to protect the larger civilian community. It has gone through a very slow buildup to its current troop strength of 7,000, and it's had a slight modification of its mandate to allow it to use force to protect civilians in immediate vicinity facing imminent violence. The AU presence has made a difference where they're deployed, but bear in mind that Darfur is a region as large as the entire country of Iraq. So 7,000 troops on the ground have a very limited capacity in terms of the territory that they can effectively police. The African Union has never received adequate support for its mission in terms of finances, logistics, communications, intelligence, air cover, etc. So it has never been able to complete a mission that went beyond its mandate of an observer force, and it's not had the physical means to be present in larger parts of the region, ensuring greater protection for civilians. It does not have enough troops. There are not enough countries able and willing to send more adequately trained and prepared troops. And the most important point is that the African Union should not have to bear the entire burden. This, if it continues, is going to represent a sort of peacekeeping apartheid. After all, African troops have contributed to peacekeeping missions in Lebanon, in Cambodia, in the Balkans, and in many other places around the world. Is the international community really saying to Africa that the international community is not prepared to contribute to peacekeeping missions in Africa? I don't think that is what the international community wants to say. And so international intervention is necessary now. Responding to genocide and other crimes against humanity is the responsibility of the entire international community, and the United Nations is the appropriate vehicle for such an intervention. This is a viable option that should be immediately pursued by the international community, and it is one that is based upon African precedents. We believe that such a UN action in support of the African Union can and will provide critical support to the AU mission and provide security to the people of Darfur. So the UN must act to reinforce the AU's efforts. It must acknowledge that the African Union, in this framework of international security, acted as the first responders to a crisis. But they do not have the capacity, nor should they be left with the obligation of fulfilling the entire mission. One only needs to look to precedents of UN or international peacekeeping efforts that have taken over from African regional forces in order to save the lives of millions of innocent civilians. These precedents include, but are not limited to, Sierra Leone in 1999, where the UN took over from an ECOWAS force, in Liberia in 2003, where the UN also took over from an ECOWAS force, and it did it in a matter of 2 months only, and Cote d'Ivoire, where ECOWAS and France were both authorized to play a peacekeeping role in 2003, and a UN mission was established in 2004, and in Burundi, where the African Union, in its very first peacekeeping mission, handed off to the United Nations in 2004. There is nothing at all unusual or unprecedented about saying that the African Union, to its credit, was the first responder, has done what it can, and now needs and deserves the support of the entire international community to assume responsibility for protecting the people of Darfur and achieving the other objectives I enumerated. The African Union, of course, announced in January of this year that it is committed in principle to a transition to a larger United Nations force. Kofi Annan has said that a UN mission needs to be larger, more mobile, and much better equipped than the current AU mission. He has referred to this transition from an AU mission to a UN mission as inevitable. As inevitable because he and others consider it part of the unique international responsibility to protect. The language around which was recently adopted in September last year at the UN Millennium Plus 5 summit. Not only does each individual state have a responsibility to protect its own citizens from crimes against humanity, the international community has a responsibility to protect in accordance with Chapters 6 and 7 of the UN Charter, and to take action in accordance with Chapter 7 of the UN Charter should national authorities fail to protect their populations from genocide, war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and crimes against humanity. And, of course, the UN Commission of Inquiry into Sudan found at the beginning of last year that, indeed, the government of Sudan was responsible for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and stated that the top priority had to be the protection of civilians in Darfur. Leading up to last Friday's African Union Peace and Security Council summit, there was a great expectation that the African Union would formally request that the United Nations begin a process of rehatting the African Union force to make it a UN mission, to give it a mandate for protection of civilians, and to begin the process of creating a more robust force, a more mobile force, a force more able to achieve the objectives that we've discussed. Unfortunately, the decision coming out of Addis last Friday essentially defers to the government of Sudan on the issue of timing and on the terms of a UN operation in Darfur. Of course, the government of Sudan waged a visible public relations campaign demeaning the United Nations, suggesting that a UN mission in Sudan would be met with a jihad, characterizing any UN mission in Sudan as some kind of Western invasion or colonialization, failing to mention, of course, that the Sudanese government is fully cooperating with a UN mission in southern Sudan composed of troops from outside of Africa as well as Africa. But nevertheless, this campaign of intimidation, of insinuation, including an insinuated threat that somehow al-Qaeda would attack any such UN force were it to be deployed, has apparently had somewhat of an effect and has cowed the international community from fulfilling its international responsibility to protect. But this failure of the African Union to formally request a transition to the UN should not be misunderstood to be a African Union failure. It is the failure of the larger international community, particularly the powerful Western countries that have been hiding behind the African Union, hiding behind the slogan of African solutions for African problems, because of their unwillingness to commit the resources, political, financial, and security required to bring these crimes against humanity to an end in Darfur. There is, however, still a emerging consensus around the need for a robust international protection force, and I doubt that this will ultimately continue to be trumped by the manipulations of the government of Sudan. The United States and the international community must prioritize the people of Darfur and must expend every effort to overcome the obstacles to UN force. The U.S. mission at the United Nations has already been working on a draft resolution for Security Council consideration to achieve the rehatting of the AU force and the authorization of a Chapter 7 UN force to provide the protection necessary. Finally, let me conclude by saying that U.S. policy here is also highly problematic. On the one hand, the United States government has acknowledged that there is a genocide occurring in Darfur, Sudan. Indeed, it's almost been a year and a half since the U.S. government made this acknowledgement. And, of course, most recently, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has reiterated that genocide continues to occur in Darfur. The State Department's country reports on human rights just released this month confirms that genocide continues in Darfur. And yet the United States has failed to take the actions necessary to provide international leadership to end this unique crime against humanity. And it raises the question of the mixed objectives of the U.S. government, which seems to be prioritizing the so-called war against terrorism, where they view the government of Sudan as a potential ally because of intelligence sharing regarding Osama bin Laden, who used to live in Khartoum, and al-Qaeda. It's gone so far as to the public acknowledgement that the Central Intelligence Agency sent a private plane to Khartoum to pick up General Abdallah Gush, the head of the Mukhabarat, the intelligence services in Sudan, and fly him here to Washington for high-level talks. This is an individual who has been identified by the UN Commission of Inquiry as a potential author of these crimes against humanity in Darfur, and whose name has been provided on the list to the International Criminal Court. Of course, the U.S. government is equally stated its concern about the need to implement the comprehensive peace agreement between the South and the North in Sudan. And so it would list these three objectives as ending genocide in Darfur, implementing the North-South peace agreement, but I believe it is accurate to say that in this hierarchy of interests, the highest interest seems to be collaboration with the government in Khartoum because of the intelligence collaboration in the so-called war on terror. And this is sadly reminiscent of the Cold War, when the United States was willing to embrace some of the worst regimes in the world on the rationale that somehow this was advancing our larger geostrategic goals. I hope we will, in our discussion, keep the focus on the needs to protect the people of Darfur and note our responsibility to help provide that protection. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Good afternoon. I would like first of all to thank the U.S. Peace Institute for the opportunity. After all, this is the first time for me to be in this building, and that should tell a lot. But eventually I would like to thank Dr. David Smock for the opportunity here. I would like, since this is the first time for me to have an opportunity to say anything in this place, to say in a nutshell way that what the first speaker suggested about how to do in Darfur is most of the time based on even deliberately distorted perception of the situation there or misperception of the situation in Darfur. So I would disband within the framework of the points. Okay, thank you. The points I made here. A question of how and when the conflict started this will help us to diagnose, to have a better diagnosis of the situation in order to come out with specific practical action-oriented means of resolving the issue in Darfur. Unfortunately, as you just heard, that the whole blame of this conflict has been placed on one party, and I think that's one of the first shortcomings of analysis of action-oriented strategy of resolving the problem of lifting the suffering of the people in Darfur. With a little bit of historical perspective, we should stress the fact that this is this phase of rebellion in Darfur, or this very particular conflict in Darfur, used to be from the beginning there, due to the composition of the population in Darfur, due to the means of subsistence in the region itself, similar to what you used to have in this country between the ranchers and cattle herders in southeast United States, the ecological problem of cycle of drought in the region also contributed to that. In fact, European administration, Rodolf Slatin, it's called Slatin Pasha, who was sent to Darfur in 1881, as the governor reported in his famous book, Sword and Fire in Sudan, which was printed, by the way, in 1894 for the first time. He said that he was unable to travel to the northwestern part of the province because of a fight between the Mahariya and Bidayat Arabs. Ironically, he called Bidayat or Rizegat, he called them Arabs, because this is one of the distorted images about Arab and non-Arab in Darfur. Accidentally, in 2002, the fight broke between those two groups again. This is just about 3 years ago. Two groups over grazing land, and it led to this larger conflict in 2003. Since 1960, more than 13 major conflicts took place in Darfur due to dispute over land ownership. Thousands of people lost their lives as a result of that. So how did it started? According to the report of the International Commission of Inquiry, most reports indicate that the government was taken by surprise by the intensity of the attacks, as it was ill-prepared to confront such a rapid military onslaught. Furthermore, the looting by rebels of government weaponry strengthening their position. An additional problem was that the fact that the government apparently was not in position of sufficient military resources, as many of its forces were still located in the south, and those present in Darfur were mainly located in the major urban centers. Following initial attacks by the rebels against rural police posts, the government decided to withdraw most police forces to urban center. This means that the government did not have de facto control over the rural areas, which was where the rebels based, unquote. The result was a security vacuum, of course, led to the huge displacement where people took refuge around the urban centers where the law enforcement is available. I mean, people should not ignore the fact that most of the internally displaced people camps are around the urban centers, or around the major cities in Darfur, rather than in rural areas, which means that people do not fear the government. People feel that wherever they have law enforcement, that's where they should go. This is in contrast to allegation that the government of Sudan is intending to wipe out these people. This is one of the reasons, among others, of course, that made to conclude on page 4 of its report that I'm referring here again to the United Nations Security Commission, quote, the commission concluded that the government of Sudan has not pursued a policy of genocide. Well, now this is a position of the Canadian Parliament, of the British Parliament, of entire EU, Arab Leagues, any single country in the world except the United States characterize the situation therefore as something other than genocide. So the justification, we have also to raise the question, justification of the rebellion itself. They cited marginalization. Let us read what United Nations Inquiry Commission said about that on page 17 of their report. Quote, from the time of British colonization to date, the focus of attention has been on both the central region where the Blue and White Niles meet. Since development and construction are centered in Khartoum and on the fertile region of Al Jazeera,
where long fiber cotton has been cultivated as the country's main crop. With the exception of these regions, the rest of the Sudan's wide territories have remained largely marginalized and neglected, including Darfur and other regions like Kordofan, the Nuba Mountain, the east of the Sudan, and the south, even the northern region between the border with Egypt and Khartoum has remained a desolate desert area, unquote. So the question is, should everyone in this, if you have the entire country described by the United States as marginalized, would it be justified that the people would carry arms and being help and being and gain sympathy from the international community for carrying arms against the state, or there should be some peaceful means of try to redress their grievances? The other thing is that the region of Darfur is inhibited by so-called Arabs and non-Arabs. The question again, why would only three tribes out of 83 feel marginalization, which means lack of services and justices? Why? The question of racism, Arabs versus Africans, Alex D. Wall, who is one of the critics of the government of Sudan and a scholar who made his field work for his PhD dissertation in the region, said, quote, characterization that Darfur was Darfur conflict was as Arabs versus Africans obscure the reality. Darfur's Arabs are black, indigenous African Muslims, just like Darfur's non-Arabs, unquote. And gladly we have a scholar who is specialist in Sudanese politics for a long time, Dr. Peter Pechtold here, would correct me if I am wrong on that. This is being used to attract attention in the West, this injection of the racial dimension of the problem is deliberately similar to the campaigns of slavery which used to be around here for some times, which is evaporated now almost completely. The timing of the conflict itself is problematic. The International Crisis Group quoted in its report of November 2004 what the leader of SLA had said to the French news agency, quote, the government, this is Manai Arkoy, the government is negotiating with the South because of pressures from the international community and military pressure in the South. A peace accord with SPLM will be a way for the government to regroup to suppress the other marginalized areas, including the West and our movement in particular. We want a comprehensive peace agreement. We will represent an obstacle to the achievement of peace. So the timing itself was based on speculation that because of the peace between the North and the South, logically the Sudanese army will have a free hand to suppress other rebellion groups in different parts of the country. And also to attract the international community, of course, by creating a huge humanitarian catastrophe like that one, by attacking, by removing people from their places in order to attract the international community, as the leader of SLA himself said that. And one of the reasons also, external factor in prolongation of the conflict, I think domestic politics in the United States, such as hasty characterization of the conflict as a genocide, has contributed a great deal as an obstacle to resolving this issue in Sudan. Because that hasty, we know that the context where the United States adopted this, this was in presidential election year, and I'm not the one who is saying that. Senator Danforth, special envoy for the peace in Sudan, said this clearly in July on a show with the BBC, the Panorama. He said that. He said it in a very plain English, that the United States has adopted this characterization of genocide for domestic political consumption. And when the reporter asked him, do you mean the religious right, he said yes. So when you characterize a situation like this, a humanitarian tragedy of this magnitude as genocide, everybody should be waiting for the international community to intervene. And that's a very strong message to the rebels that there is no sense of trying to reach any kind of peaceful agreement with the government. They should be waiting for the international community to come and to fix this problem. The other thing is the methodology of the United States in reaching that conclusion by sending a team of diplomats from the State Department, not to Darfur itself, where you have, as he said, 2 million people displaced, but to the neighboring Chad to interview 1,100 people there in the refugees in Chad and to come up with this very serious characterization of the situation as genocide. We think that by adopting this itself, they aborted any opportunity of trying to reach a peaceful solution to the situation there. Activist tactics to weaken or even topple the government with all the time, the same people who used to shed crocodile tears on the situation of Southern Sudanese, asking for a peaceful solution. When we finish that, none of these organizations even issued a statement welcoming the peace agreement took place between the North and the South, which is a huge success for the American diplomacy. I would say for the last 20 or 30 years, they just turned their back to that very historic achievement and is starting this issue of Darfur. I'm sure that two or 3 years from now, they will find something else in the East or the ancient Nubia to dwell on. So I'm not questioning the intention of millions of good people in this country, but I think for many activists, this has become an industry. All these factors discourage the rebels from reaching and deal, hoping that a military intervention would be in their interest, thus prolong the suffering of the displaced and refugees. Astonishingly, these are the same groups used to claim that they were working to realize peace between the North and the South. Second thing is the U.S. Congress' historic animosity toward the government of Sudan materialized in a number of resolutions and acts have been sending encouraging messages to the rebels to continue their campaign. Due to these factors, the rebels have shown disrespect to the African Union, calling for NATO and multinational peacekeeping forces from day one. This has been their position from the beginning, that they want the international community to intervene in Darfur. So the question now is, what has to be done now? We think that, first of all, my friend from the Africa Action has expressed regret for the decision of the African Union to still keep this file within the African House. It is very regrettable to me that an organization called itself Africa Action, rather than to strengthen the African Union, this fledgling body, in order to fix the problems in Africa, that an organization like this one would trying to undermine the African Union itself. Yeah. Well, Dr. Jendai Fraser and Kofi Annan confirmed in February that the African Union is effective. Dr. Jendai Fraser said that in a press conference on the 3rd of February when she was asked whether the genocide is still going on in Darfur. She said that the African Union troops are effective in drastically diminishing the large-scale killing in the regions, which means that if it is genocide, they are successful in stopping that genocide. Kofi Annan, after he met with President Bush, was introduced by the CNN. He said that African Union troops are effective where they are deployed. So the most logical thing, according to these statements, should be to bolster the African Union. He said, nobody questioned. I never came across anyone who questioned the ability of the African Union to bring back peace to that. But everybody's talking about the resources. Chapter 8 of the African Union obliged the United Nations to help them, to give them the money, resources, in order to do their job. So the most rational thing to do, if one is free of any ulterior objectives of regime change, it could be to bolster the African Union, to give them the resources, to train them. The government of Sudan expressed many times that we have no problem for the NATO to provide them with whatever they need. If they think that they need 20,000 troops in Darfur, there would be no problem with that. So to jump from this very logical thing that everybody is saying that the African Union is effective, is doing a good job, they need resources, so provide them with resources, as simple as that. But to jump to the multinational peacekeeping as the only way to resolve the problem there does not make any sense to me. The other thing which needed to be done is to pressure the rebels. Of course, the United Nations Security Council also named three countries in the neighboring in the neighborhood of providing them with ammunition and arms. So there should be pressure on these people who are fueling the problem there. Also, what we need is to strengthen the N'Djamena agreement by forcing the rebels to pinpoint the sites of the areas they occupied. Unfortunately, this is stipulated clearly in the African Union decision 3 days ago, that this should be done. I mean, from the beginning, if the international community pressure these people to pinpoint the sites they occupied, was stipulated clearly in the main agreement. That would make it much easier for the African Union troops to monitor the situation, to reduce the numbers of killings and all of these things. And contrary to what the previous speaker said about the situation, I heard less than a week ago from an official from the AID that the situation is humanitarian. Situation in Darfur is under control. He said the mortality rate dropped drastically. There is no any symptoms of famine in the region. So I wonder where he came up with those informations. I think also one of the reasons, if we're really serious about the suffering of the people in Darfur, if we really would like to bring peace about, to allow these people to go back to their places, also to stop the activists and Congress campaign against the government of national unity, people should not forget the fact that we have a new situation in Sudan. We have a government of national unity, which is from the government and the SPLM and most of the political parties in there. This should be supported in order to resolve the other issues, the other problem in the country. And I think also it is very, very important for the United States to lift the sanctions against Sudan, to strengthen the comprehensive peace agreement between the South and the North, and to show the people in Darfur and other areas that peace would bring good to the people. In conclusion, I would like to say that we are not in denial of anything. We really acknowledge the fact that we have a huge humanitarian tragedy in Darfur. We have hundreds of thousands of people are displaced. They have a couple of hundred of thousands also refugees in neighboring Chad. This is not acceptable situation. the international community and other NGOs and intentioned people around the world should try their best to help us in order to fix the situation there, to allow these people to go back to their villages and to resume their normal life. We don't think that international intervention would resolve the problem. We don't think that just by sending troops and aircrafts you would resolve the problem in an area which the size of the state of Texas. We think that the most important thing should be to encourage the parties to try to sign as soon as possible a peaceful agreement which will stop hostilities there, which will maintain the ceasefire in the region, and which would allow free access of humanitarian aid to the different parts of the region, and most of all to allow these ID people and refugees to go back to their villages and resume their lives there. We think that, again, to do that is to support negotiations in Abuja, and also to provide the African Union. There should be a campaign of throughout the world in order to provide the African Union with the resources to make them do a good job in the region. We think this is the most rational, the most logical way of doing things without jumping to the multinational peace groups in the regions. And we hope that the African-American different organizations here would also help us and would play a more action-oriented strategy towards the country. I never met Mr. Saleh Bourque in my life. I've been here for the last 5 years. I wonder how many times did he travel to Sudan, how many Sudanese officials he met in order to discuss this issue with them. We think that's the most logical thing for this. The people who perceive Africa as their mother continent, they should be in the business of resolving action strategy rather than to join the other groups in trying to make the situation in our country worse. Thank you very much again for your listening.
I want to thank both of our speakers. They have presented dramatically different portrayals of reality in Sudan and Darfur and the international community, and have presented diametrically opposed solutions to the peacekeeping problem in Darfur. But I think they have effectively laid out the issues and the differing points of view on this contentious issue. I want to throw it open for questions and comments from the floor, but first I want to, I won't put him on the spot, to see whether Charlie Snyder might, who for several years has been at the center of American policy formulation on Sudan, whether you'd be prepared to make a few comments and remarks.
Speaking in my personal capacity.
Okay.
I'll go over to your microphone.
Okay.
I think you'll see that the government of the United States has engaged with the full panoply of weapons against this. AID is engaged. The State Department is engaged. The Defense Department has been studying what can be done to radically change the situation, because we are focused on the crucial piece of the problem, which is the tragedy in Darfur continues. People are still dying. As the Secretary said, we characterize it as genocide. Some of the people in Europe characterize it as crimes against humanity. Whatever it is, it's very wrong and it needs to end. And that's what our policy is focused on. And it's focused on the practical. It's not focused on taking high-minded positions for taking high-minded positions' sake. It's trying to come up with an actual solution. The African Union has done yeoman's work, as the speakers both have conceded. There are not enough of them on the ground. There need to be more of them. but Africa is very busy with peacekeeping. As Salibuka pointed out, ECOWAS has been engaged and has done yeoman's work all over West Africa. It's still heavily engaged despite the United Nations coming in several instances in Sierra Leone and Liberia and other places. Africa is very busy with peacekeeping and trying to pull its own weight. The South Africans, who would normally be a go-to resource for this kind of thing, have been engaged constantly in Burundi until they hand it over. The Ghanaians are out doing international peacekeeping. So Africa has submitted its fair share to international peacekeeping. And what we're looking at now is some way to take this African peacekeeping mission to a successful solution. I think both of the speakers have pointed out the ideal solution would be for Abuja to produce a political result, a context in which the world can act in response to an African solution to an African problem. We shouldn't forget that the Abuja negotiation is being run by Africans. Salim is in the lead for them, and they are making progress. They're not moving fast enough because people are dying. One of the advantages we had in the situation in the South was we had managed to get in place a successful ceasefire very early in the negotiations. As long as the guns are quiet, you can let the diplomats and the politicians squabble over commerce and word choices, would, should, could, big dog, small puppy, whatever you want. The trouble here is the ceasefire hasn't helped, and the rebels do bear some responsibility for that. Just because the government of Sudan has said it doesn't mean there isn't some truth to it, that the rebels really do believe that the international community will step in some fashion and dramatically change the ground, whether that's regime change or something else. They believe that. They're fairly unsophisticated politically, and therefore they've been, to some degree, deluded by this hope that somebody's going to step in and give them what they have not necessarily won politically or militarily. We have done our best as the United States in meetings with them to make it clear to them that that is not possible. What's possible are the kinds of things that are contained in the North-South Peace Agreement. This was always meant to be an agreement that would cover marginalized areas versus the center. Yes, we used the dramatic personae, if you will, of the North versus the South to structure the agreement. 2 million people had died in the South. And as the ambassador rightly points out, the fact that this ended is a major victory, not necessarily for American diplomacy, but certainly for international diplomacy. The Kenyans and IGAD were in the chair when a lot of that negotiation went on. That agreement contains the political solution. The rebels need to be brought more carefully along to see that. And at the same time, the situation on the ground has to be stabilized. There is another complication that neither of them referred to. And I think we're going to have to make it worse before we make it better. The budding civil war in Chad is clearly right on the border between Sudan and Chad. The Zagawa people in particular, Mini Manali, the leader of one of the rebel groups, is in fact a Zagawa, are one of the principal actors in this drama as we reach a new stage in the Deby regime in Chad. Fighting and movement back across the border allows the bad actors, whether they're government-backed, rebel-backed, or in some cases, I'm beginning to see the emergence of some warlordism. People are in this for their own reasons. All of that witch's brew feeds on instability. There are people out there with guns that don't want this to end, and it's going to take a more robust force. If that can be done with a NATO reinforcement and logistics and intelligence and other things of the African Union, so be it. My military experience tells me there are not enough Africans on the ground right now. We need more men. The UN will need more men. The UN is not going to be a magic bullet for this. In case you've missed it, there's more peacekeeping going on in the world right now than ever. There's a significant strain and drain on worldwide peacekeeping resources. The kind of quality people that you need to put on the ground in a situation like this, where there are heavily armed people on their own ground that have their own reasons, differing reasons, to want to keep this fight going, you need serious peacekeepers. The Africans are the best choice that we can find some more. The North Africans haven't been engaged in this. There are perfectly respectable armies in Algeria, Tunisia. Egypt is a neighbor, not a good choice, but better than no choice at all. And if you need the manpower, you may have to look to those places to get the manpower. Yes, we can bring Indian peacekeepers in and Pakistani peacekeepers in, but we need to do something in the near term. the UN cannot get there for several months. The reason they could move as quickly as they did in the two-month time frame was the ground was well prepared, the base camps were laid for an increase in manpower and other things. The situation was stable. The situation's not stable. They're having the devil's own time getting up to the proper number in the southern operation, in which they are not opposed. This country, because of the 20, 24, 27, 50 years of civil war, depending on how you want to count, has no infrastructure. So even with the best will in the world, the infrastructure in Darfur will be hard-pressed to sustain a bigger force. The best answer in the short run actually is going to be a dog's breakfast, something from every one of these categories. More Africans that we can get them, more local police that actually do their jobs, maybe some support from some of these southern units that were promised by Dr. Garang when he was still alive. Manpower is one of the problems, and we need to address that. Resources are the other problem. Resources from us. There's a supplemental moving that will put our money on the ground. But the European Union can't put more money on the ground for July. They've spent every cent they have in their peacekeeping account already in Darfur. The British have found $34 million. That will tide the African Union over for a month or two. The real answer is for the activists and others to put more pressure on Congress, but also on the European parliaments to put more resources in the hands of the Africans or in the hands of the United Nations. The excuse that it's easier to do this through the United Nations shouldn't be allowed to block an African solution if one is possible. We still have some possibilities here. Am I optimistic or not? I think the African Union statement said the right things. It allows all possibilities. It allows NATO support to the African Union. It allows the UN transition. But it puts the focus back where it belongs. It demands action in Abuja. It demands that all the parties, the international actors as well as the Africans, rededicate themselves to coming to some kind of successful agreement. Salim Salim has put on the table a 23-page document that proposes to fill the cracks and the gaps in the existing peace plan that the Chadians negotiated. That really is one of the keys that has to be focused on in the short term, and we all need to push in that direction. And even though I don't do Sudan on a day-to-day basis, I can tell you that the strategy of the State Department and the government of the United States is to try and do that. Whether we'll be successful or not depends on the goodwill of the parties. I've seen some more flexibility recently on the government's part. I've seen some hopeful signs that the rebels are finally drawn a little bit closer together. But they need more people on the ground to monitor that, and I don't see it right now. I think, as usual, the solution is going to be somewhere between the two positions you've heard here. It's going to be somewhere between a pristine African solution and somewhere between a total European-led or NATO or Western-dominated solution. There is real reason to believe that we could draw bad actors in who have agendas that have nothing to do with Sudan. That is a very real possibility. Whether it's us, the Canadians, any Western force currently in the Middle East runs that risk. And we shouldn't forget Sudan is in the Middle East in this context. And it's wild open country out there. It's very easy to operate against any one of these forces. And they'll be fragile forces, even if they're Western. They're going to be on ground they don't know. They're going to be at the edge of the logistics base. They'll be able to protect themselves somewhat better than the Africans, but not necessarily to suppress a consistent death of 1,000 cuts. The only real end to this conflict is a political one. We have to buy the space, and I think that's what we're after. I think the fact that all the Europeans showed up at the pledging conferences in Brussels and in Paris say that the world is still engaged on this. I think Kofi Annan's activity on this is proof of that. The president's own activity on that. He's spoken out very forcefully on this, and I suspect he means to pound on us bureaucrats to see that something like what I'm saying happens. But don't necessarily look for NATO. Look for NATO as a piece of Western support for the African Union. Maybe look even for Arab League support for the African Union. There are four Maghreb states, don't forget, that are also members of the Arab League. If you're looking for money and resources, I submit to you the price of oil has gone up quite a bit. There are funds available in the Arab League, and they're about to have their meeting. So there are other possibilities. don't tie yourself to one possibility. Tie yourself to the solution, which is this has got to stop. It's a humanitarian crisis. The right answer, as it always is in these cases, is ultimately a political solution. And the right ultimate solution is the one we've been calling for from the beginning, which is these people have to be put back on the ground they were driven off of. And the underlying problem that the ambassador referred to has to be addressed. And that involves doing something in a region of increasing scarcity and overpopulation based on the resources to support the population. And that is a developmental issue that is going to take years, even if we plug the humanitarian gap. And it's going to take activity by all people over time, not to make this the crisis of the day, turn the cameras off and go away, because that won't fix the problem. The rebellion will be back in 2 or 3 years. There are too many people for the resources on the ground. It's a rich country. We've pledged billions of dollars in reconstruction for the South as well as the West. And that number needs to be put on the ground, as opposed to I promised 100 million here, and when the cameras go off, I put 10 million out. We don't do that nearly as much as people think we do. But a lot of the people that are pledged in these cases have bad histories. And I'd call on the activists in the group, stay on that with your counterparts abroad, whether they're in Japan or Europe, to make sure those numbers get there. I still think we can do this, but I think we're running an increasingly disadvantaged race in which too many people are starting to die again. The violence is going up, and there are new actors that don't necessarily care about Sudan involved. I think the deadline the African Union has set of 30 April is realistic, but only if we all put pressure on, and we will. And again, I'm not speaking for the government. I'm not supposed to speak for the government on Sudan, but just to give you some context, I'm now simply an intelligence officer again, where it's nice and quiet. But thanks for the chance to speak.
Thank you. Okay, we will take your questions and comments. If you come over to the microphone here, and you want to, Albuquerque, you want to come to the microphone over here. I think I'll let Albuquerque go first. Then you come.
Thank you. My name is Al-Bakir Mukhtar. I'm a senior fellow with the USIP. And before that, I was a human rights activist working with Amnesty International in London. And I know that the mention of Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and Africa Rights is bad news for the government of Sudan and for many other governments, similar governments. But I just wanted to start by thanking Saleh Buka for his portrayal of the problem in Darfur. I agree with every word that he said. I think this is straight talk. This is an accurate depiction of the situation on the ground. And also I agree with him that the central point here is the protection of the civilians in Darfur. This is urgent and it is needed now. And I think it is the responsibility of the international community to provide this protection urgently, whatever it takes. To talk about whether it is an AU or a UN personnel to be there, about how, I think this is secondary. The primary issue is to provide protection for the civilians of Darfur who are dying at the moment. And then how to do that? This is an open question, if the result is a protection. I also understand the predicament of His Excellency the Ambassador of Sudan, for he is put in a situation to defend the worst government in the world, with the worst human rights record ever. And I don't think the technical discussion about whether it is genocide or war crimes or crimes against humanity matters here. What happens has a name. If it is not genocide, I am asking the ambassador, what name he has for it? What does he call it? And also, he speaks about the marginalization as the root cause of the problems, not only in Darfur, but in other parts of Sudan. And he is suggesting that people should follow peaceful methods in trying to redress this marginalization. And the question is, then what does he say, or what is his comment on his president's open call for people to take arms if they want their rights, if they want to be talked to by his government? President Bashir of Sudan, he said openly that he only talks to people with guns, and that whoever wants to talk to them, they have to resort to arms. He invited people to take arms, and now people took arms. So also the last point about what he said about Alex Diwal, when he said that's a depiction of the problem as Arabs versus Africans obscures the problem. My question to the ambassador, then, what is the problem the problem is between who and who, if it's not between the Arabs and Africans? But at the same time, I know that why Alex Diwal said that. Alex Diwal said that because some African tribes in Darfur who are undergoing the process of Arabization and Islamization, or Arabization in particular with regard to Darfur, they identify themselves as Arabs. They are Africans, but they identify themselves as Arabs. So this is why when you can find somebody of them, an individual who calls himself an Arab, for instance, while he's a foreigner. But then Alex went on to say that in the end, there are people in Darfur who identify themselves as Arabs. There are people who identify themselves as Africans. And now, after this conflict, it has been, the polarization was clear now, because even the African groups who started to identify themselves as Arabs, they came back and resorted to their African identity. So now, as a result of the conflict, the process of Arabization in Darfur stopped, and people started to identify themselves as Africans. Thank you.
Okay. I think we'll take three or four questions and comments, and then let the speaker respond. So go ahead.
Okay. My question is for Ambassador.
Will you identify yourself?
Sure. My name is Kimberly Slapsky, and my question is for Ambassador Ahmed. You, as he had mentioned, you had spoken about these claims by the rebel groups of their marginalization. And I wanted to know, in your opinion, how do you see, or how do you characterize that marginalization? Is it political, economic, social? How do you view that? And has the government of Sudan seriously considered any of these objections, and in what way?
Okay, thank you. Yeah, we're going to gather up questions, and then they'll respond. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Roman Shpak, in my private capacity, formerly with American University. I have two very brief questions, one for the ambassador, one for Dr. Booker. First, for the ambassador, I'm very happy to see the ambassador or any representative of Sudanese government in such a venue. I hope we could see more of representatives of the embassy. We have at least six universities here. I hope you can send somebody to represent the embassy and the government position. Okay. Also, I think one problem that we have in the United States and abroad is that we have very few people able to travel to Sudan freely, and you have a direct influence on granting visas to U.S. citizens, so if you could look at that. Now, the question is about what is in dispute, what is not in dispute. I don't think it's in dispute today who started the rebellion. I don't think anybody challenges the fact that the rebels attacked the military bases and the government was not prepared. What is in dispute, however, is the government's response. How do you personally respond in your official capacity to the factual evidence, the pictures, the proof, testimony of government helicopters attacking unarmed civilians, citizens of Sudan in Darfur? Is that renegade forces of Sudanese army? Why are they not being punished? Are they just misrepresented, doctored photos? How do you respond? Now, the question for Dr. Booker is more broad. What is the end game for Darfur, or for Sudan, for that matter? If we have the ceasefire, if we have the implementation, do you think we should talk about the restructuring of the government of Sudan to avoid problems like the ambassador referred to, as are we going to be talking about the east in 2 years? Are we going to be talking about the south again? Are we going to talk about the center, Kordofan? In other words, what is the ultimate solution according to your vision for Sudan or states like Sudan, where the regions have been marginalized for quite a long time, where the government is unresponsive, is deemed illegitimate by the majority of the population, and is unwilling to talk to anybody who does not hold a gun or directly challenges it? So what is your vision for that? Thank you.
I think Carola will take your question, and then we'll get the collective response.
Thank you very much, both to Your Excellency and Dr. Booker, for, I think, raising some very interesting issues, but also perhaps highlighting one of the problems with the discussion that we seem to have right now. In some ways, the title of the panel is a bit of a misnomer, because peacekeeping presumes that there is a peace to keep.
Yes.
And yet we speak primarily about protection of civilians, which presumes that we don't yet have a peace on the ground. So I challenge both of you perhaps to give us a little bit more guidance on how you would see us, the international community, Americans, others, as well as the government of Sudan, addressing very concretely this question of civilian protection under conditions of conflict, not of peace. You have some idea of how we can perhaps disaggregate the role for the AU, the role for the UN, in achieving, on the one hand, the peacekeeping mission, which is a ceasefire, a ceasing of violence, and on the other hand, the delivery of humanitarian assistance, the physical protection of civilians in the camps and in the country, given that we have limited resources all around, as you've so well put it. Thank you.
Good question.
Ambassador, I'll call on you first. You want to stand up and respond to the various questions and points?
It's, what I'm trying to, in answering the question of Dr. Al-Bakr, was respond to the defending the worst government in the world. I don't know what his yardstick for came to this conclusion. I mean, after all, Sudan now has effectively a multi-party system because we have more than 15 political parties. We have more than 20 daily newspapers in the country. We have the SPLM becoming part and parcel of the government of national unity. We have the National Democratic Alliances, the umbrella for Northern. Sorry, I'm really sorry. Sorry for that, you know. So what I'm trying to tell you that it's very hard to Khalid, please take this out. Sorry for that. We have to carry it all the time, as you know. Well, so it's, of course, you are free to think that way, but I think that this is a little bit harsher assessment of the situation there. So, and I'm curious about the yardstick. I mean, this is one thing. The other thing is that Sudan, within 2 years from now, is going to have, according to the CPA, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, general elections, which will be monitored by the international community. I think the country is more on the track more than ever before. So I respect what you say, but I disagree with you on that. With respect to the issues of modernization, yeah, of course, I did not deny the fact that people in Darfur perceive themselves in different ways. But what I'm trying to say is that they are not fighting because of this ethnic background. They are not fighting each other because of that. They are fighting each other because of limited resources, because of the ecological factor of desertification, because every day the Sahara is gaining more grounds, which will bring people much closer to each other there. These are the real issues. There are Arabs and non-Arabs in Darfur, of course, but they, according to every single research I came across, they are mixed. They are even Alex Deval called them black Arabs, because it is very difficult to distinguish you an Arab from non-Arab. You have Arabic speaker groups, you have people who bilingual in the region. I remember we went with Secretary Powell in his plane to Darfur, and the governor of northern Darfur asked him to distinguish an Arab from non-Arab there. He said, "You look the same to me." In fact, he was a whiter one among them there. So this is what I'm trying to say about the ethnics. So it's not the reason, it's not the cause, roots of this problem there. It's rather because the 13 conflicts I mentioned from 1960 up to this time, some of them were between Arabs versus Arabs, like the famous fight between Rezegat and Maalia. Both of them are Arabs, nomads. We have also war, many wars between Fur and Masalit, Zagawa and Fur. All of these cases of wars between Africans versus Africans. So there must be some other reasons than ethnicity here. With the lady here about the marginalization issue, we have among us one of the distinguished politicians in our country, Professor Muhammad Ibrahim Khalil. He could shed some lights on the political situation in Sudan since our independence, where we have two major religious sects. The central as well as the western part of the country, most of the people there are affiliated to the Ansar group. From that Ansar group, we have the Ummah party evolved from that background. We have in the north Khatmiyya, and the east we have a political entity evolved from that that group called Ittihad al-Demokrati. So the situation is not as there are some ethnic groups in monopoly of the politics in the center. This is not the case, because this will distort the case. I hope that he will find a chance to clarify that a little bit. But I think the issue of marginalization is addressed by the comprehensive peace agreement. I mean, it's not just between the north and the south. It's between the north and the south, also the designated three areas, the Nuba Mountain, the southern Blue Nile, and Abyei. Okay? And also the comprehensive peace agreement suggested a more broader federal system in the country, which will allow people in different parts of the country the same treatment of wealth sharing, power sharing with the center. So this is why I think that the CPA itself is very relevant to the situation going on in Darfur as well now. This is how you address this issue of marginalization, in my opinion. The gentleman here about, thank you for your invitation. I would be glad to attend anything you have.
the government response on that, the helicopters attacking people, well, you know, unfortunately, in a lot of conflicts going on around the world now, you find, unfortunately, civilian caught in the middle of that. In my position, I'm not going to elaborate more on that. But it is this is the situation, unfortunately. If the rebels sometimes will take some villagers as shield, as human shield, if they their hideouts is among people sometimes, does not suggest that the government is deliberately, because there is no any military use of that to attack unarmed civilian people and by helicopters. I think this is, unfortunately, this is the case. Sudan is not unique on that. In every single conflict today, we have civilians being caught in the middle and unfortunately play some kind of price for that. Dr. Weil, about the protection role for the... Yeah, I think this is a very important issue, and this is the more relevant one now. The priority should be for the protection of the people there. And we suggested a couple of months ago to the some officials here that to start some kind of protection methods in Darfur. We even suggested that for the government of Sudan, the United Nations, the U.S. and others, to designate some areas there, some major villages being affected by this tragic situation, and all of us together help protecting these villages, digging wells there, bring some prefab homes for the people there, bring an alternative to wood fuel for that, and allow, and you could repeat this in some other places. I mean, we are open, the government, to my knowledge, is open to any kind of a practical suggestion that would allow much better protection to the suffering population in Darfur. I mean, we have no any reservation on asking for help for anybody who are open to any suggestion to that. Even some NGOs here contacting me on some message. We are entertaining that. I mean, we agree on that. We agree that the priority should be to protect the people and to allow them eventually to go back to their places. Thank you.
Yes, briefly, I'd like to respond to some things in addition to the question. I have the feeling of deja vu. Ages ago, I used to debate representatives of the apartheid South African regime. And, of course, these were government representatives that had no legitimacy, that represented a minority regime, and would respond as if they represented the people of their own country. And they used this term also about, you know, they would talk about whites and non-whites, just as the representative of the Sudanese government talks about Arabs and non-Arabs. There are no such thing as non-Arabs. You don't identify your identity by negating your identity. There are Africans. And there are Arabs. And as my colleague pointed out, it is a question of how people self-identify. Identity is subjective, and you can have multiple identities. And particularly in the history of Sudan, we've seen this historical process of Arabization where Africans are, through a long process, self-identifying as Arabs. And as my colleague pointed out, this genocide that's going on has sort of ended that process of Arabization, and there's a much more militant African identification. And I'll come back to that. But we must be clear also in discussing that there's no moral equivalence between the government of Sudan
and the rebels who've taken up arms, whether that's in Darfur, whether that's in southern Sudan, or whether that is any other part of Sudan. As was acknowledged, the majority of Sudanese are marginalized. Power is centralized in the state, held by a minority group, and it has been held historically by this minority since independence in 1956. So the demands of Southerners, the demands of people in the East, the demands of people in the West, the demands of people in the North are the same. It's there for their human rights to be acknowledged and for them to have the right to determine their own futures and not have it imposed by a government that holds power essentially by force of arms and the use of violence. And the use of genocide as a methodology is not new in Sudan. It is a methodology of counterinsurgency that the government of Sudan has used in southern Sudan, in the Nuba Mountains, and now in Darfur. In other words, when rebels rise up and attack military installations, the government of Sudan has responded by targeting the civilian population specifically from whence the rebels are believed to come. And this targeting occurs on the basis of ethnic and racial identity, as is happening in Darfur. The question specifically put to me, well, another thing I have to respond to is the organization I represent is the oldest advocacy organization in the United States, and we are not trying to undermine the African Union. In my opening remarks, I indicated that it is the African Union of all the international and regional organizations that has done the most. It has stepped up to negotiate the ceasefire. It has committed troops. But it has also decided that, in principle, it needs to transition to a UN force, as it has in Burundi, as was done in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and the other precedents that I offered before. I will say the one newsworthy item was that the representative of the Sudanese government did welcome 20,000 troops to be deployed to Darfur, and I think that is the most relevant thing that was shared. Specifically, I want to respond to the questions, what's the end game for Sudan, for Darfur, for the East? We realize that the Comprehensive Peace Agreement is not comprehensive. And for Southerners, it represents a victory of the acknowledgement of their right to self-determination, and they look forward to a referendum 5 years from hence where they will be able to exercise their right to self-determination. But until that time, the implementation of this peace agreement is simply a new battlefront. In other words, instead of the armed struggle, there is now a political struggle to make sure this peace agreement is implemented, to make sure that Southerners get 50% of the oil revenues, that they receive the political power that they're supposed to in proportion to the formulas established by the peace agreement. While we're focusing a good deal of this discussion on Darfur, we should recognize the CPA is not being implemented as it should, according to the timetable that it should be implemented. And regarding this issue of resources, you can be certain that the government of Sudan is not providing 50% of the oil revenues to the authorities of southern Sudan, who need these resources desperately for the reconstruction and construction and development denied to southern Sudan for so long. So what is the end game for larger question of Sudan? It is, as is obvious, I think, a national crisis, a national problem. It is not just the problem of the South. It is not just the problem of Darfur. It is a problem nationally. It is a problem, like in South Africa, of minority rule by a minority that has a fixation about its own Arab-centric identity and superiority over the rest of the country, and it has manipulated differences of religion, differences of race, differences of ethnicity to encourage conflict, to ensure that the center remains in power. And the government of Sudan has been very effective in using these divisions in the past. But one senses in Sudan that there is a growing and greater demand on the part of civil society throughout the country to see an end to this kind of minority rule. And in some instances, that has involved the taking up of arms against this unrepresentative government. So the end game, of course, is a process whereby the people of Sudan can define their own governments. For the Southerners, that means a referendum. They may vote well to secede and to form their own independent state, as they are entitled to, if that is what they choose at the end of this 5 years. I don't think the central government in Khartoum wants to see that conclusion. But for people throughout the rest of the country, for example, the people in Darfur are immediately faced with just the struggle for survival and the onslaught of this massive violence. Easterners also face similar challenges. And I think civil society actors are organizing politically to challenge these central authorities, as they have in the past, but I think there's greater unity across Sudan among civil society actors. The other question pointed out that, yes, peacekeeping is a misnomer for the current mission of the African Union or for the mission immediately envisioned for a larger force, because there is no peace agreement. There's only a ceasefire agreement that was signed in 2004 and has not been honored. And the AU mission does not have a capacity to enforce that ceasefire. It was established to monitor it. So how do you provide protection to 3 million people in Darfur who are vulnerable to the ongoing violence, the ongoing rape, and gender-based sexual violence that is occurring daily in Darfur? You provide that kind of protection by authorizing an international protection force. The UN Charter provides for several different types of forces. There's the Chapter 6, which is a where you have a peaceful settlement of dispute and you can deploy a peacekeeping operation to enforce that agreement. There is Chapter 8, where you defer to regional arrangements. You ask a regional organization to support peace and end to violence. And there's Chapter 7, where the UN can decide to act because of threats to peace, because of breaches of the peace, and because of acts of aggression, to use force to protect civilians. And so what we've been calling for all along since the beginning was the need for a Chapter 7 force with a mandate to protect civilians. That kind of security is necessary to save lives, to facilitate humanitarian relief, but it's also critical to ensure that the political process goes forward. I don't believe you will reach a peace agreement so long as there's a not adequate security in Darfur, for the people of Darfur. And most fundamentally, you need that kind of force to ensure that people can go home and rebuild the lives that have been destroyed with all their homes and everything else. I think the critical thing here in talking about what kind of force is necessary, again, I want to reiterate that the African Union was being set up to begin with when it initiated its own observer mission. Why? Because the international community failed to provide it the support it needed. What we're talking about now, more troops, logistical support, intelligence, aerial photography or satellite imagery or air cover, etc. The AU has asked NATO for more assistance than simply transporting troops from Rwanda to Darfur. It hasn't received the kind of support it has sought from the international community. And I think the African Union has the right to call on the international community to provide greater support, because it needs, in order to fulfill a greater mission, greater resources that it simply doesn't have. It does not have the additional 13,000 troops if it were to try to increase the AU force from 7,000 to 20,000. And as again, the precedents exist everywhere. I don't know why the Sudanese government would object to a UN force in Darfur, since obviously it cannot protect civilians in Darfur when it has not objected to the UN force in southern Sudan. The late Dr. John Garang, before he tragically passed away last year, argued that the UN force in southern Sudan was better needed in Darfur than it was in southern Sudan. The problem is the lack of political will, particularly on the part of the Western and powerful countries that can move this along. There's a lack of leadership. Mention was made of the leadership of the U.S. administration, but I don't see this leadership. For the U.S. government to say that genocide is occurring and the government of Sudan is responsible, a year and a half later to say that this genocide is continuing, makes it clear that our own government has failed to provide the kind of leadership necessary to ensure that this massive crime against humanity is ended. And again, I would argue it's because the U.S. has other interests it's pursuing in Sudan that involve closer collaboration with the government of Sudan. The only thing that's going to change this is citizen pressure in the United States. And that's the encouraging thing here, is that there has been a broad-based movement among civil society actors in the United States, involving secular and religious organizations, involving African American organizations, involving students, involving the Sudanese immigrant community in the United States. Every day throughout this country, there are events being held on Darfur demanding that elected representatives take action, put pressure on the U.S. administration to ensure that a force capable of protecting the people of Darfur is deployed for that purpose.
Back to our patient questioners.
Thank you very much. Jeff Kovic with the Save Darfur Coalition. And touching on what Mr. Brooker just said, both of my questions are actually for the ambassador. The first one is, given the severity of the situation that you described in Darfur, would you support a stronger mandate that really allows peacekeeping forces rather than just monitoring and observation forces in Darfur? And following up on something that you said earlier regarding the use of government helicopters and innocent civilians being killed, I guess my question is, how would you respond to photographic evidence not only of the helicopters being used, but also that coupled with African Union reports of coordinated attacks with the Janjaweed and the Sudanese government forces?
I think we'll run through all the remaining questions and then have responses since we're running short of time. So make your comments or questions brief, please.
Imad Musa from Al Jazeera Television. I had two questions. Basically, the first one is, has the Arab Union, Arab League, I know it's become irrelevant for the most part these days, but have they approached you or have you approached them, or has there been any attempt to involve them in the Darfur issue? And number two is, do you feel that the Darfur issue and kind of what Mr. Brooker was talking about has become a domestic political, it has domestic political constituency in the United States, and that's why the sudden interest of the United States in it late last year the year before, or last spring, and not really before, and is it just a political thing that will maybe subside within, you know, after midterm elections, or after it's just it goes by election cycle or something like that? Thank you.
My name is Ali Al-Shar. I'm a Sudanese. Let me just go in a quick comment for Saleh Booker. I've been before with him in the panel at Howard University. And he always keep mentioning Arab minority and African majority. First of all, just to give you a background about just Sudan. The Sudan, if we talk to the religion side, 80% of the Sudanese are Muslim, 5% are Christian, and 15% they are animists. If you go to the southern Sudan part, 63% of the southern Sudanese, they are animists. 16% only they are Christian, and 21% they are Muslim. That means there is majority Muslim in southern Sudan. It is Christian. You always hear a war between South African and Arab North. It's not everybody from the SPLA or SPLM, he's a sovereign Sudanese. You have Dr. Mansour Khalid, used to be the foreign minister of Sudan, and he's an Arab, and he's a Muslim. He's the top advisor of the SPLM. You have Yasser Arman, he's a spokesman of the SPLM, and he's a North Sudan, and he's a Muslim. Almost over 30% of the Sudanese soldier, Sudanese army, they are from the southern Sudan, who they have to be an African, who have to be, some of them they are Christian, some of them they are animists, some of them they are Muslim. Then it's not a war between Muslim and Christian, it's not between North and South, because there is a lot of North Sudan who they are with the SPLA army fighting against the government. To the Darfur section. The Darfur, when we say Arab-Kurdic African, what does that mean? We all look the same. We all Muslim. We all have the same belief. When we say Arab against African, it's two different things. One, he has a dialect language, and the other, he had Arabic language. But they all say speak Arabic. If you're talking about Arab, Verdic African. Jafar al-Numeiri, he was the president of Sudan. He's from the Danagla, he's from the north, but he's non-Arab because his tribe is non-Arab. Muhammad Ahmed al-Mahdi, who led the revolution of al-Mahdi revolution, who had defeated the British army, who was not an Arab, he's from the Kunuz tribe. The late vice president of Sudan, Az-Zubair, he's from the Danagla. He's non-Arab.
I think if you can be very brief, please.
It's not a war against Muslim, against Christian, first of all. It's not Arab against non-Arab. They all look the same. Please, I've been hearing a lot about is Arab against African. That is not the issue. The issue is about a group of one tribe trying to receive power in the rest of, Darfur, Chad, Central Africa, and they're looking to southern Libya soon, and Niger. It's the Zaghawa tribe, who right now the president of Chad is from the same tribe, the Zaghawa, is the president of Central African Republic, is from the same tribe. They always have their big dream state to include an ethnic state, Darfur, Chad, Central Africa, part of southern Libya, and Niger. They already received two countries. That is not the issue. Is an Arab against Africa. And, it's just that's not the way it is. They keep talking about it. Now let's talk about, genocide.
No, please, we've got several other people and almost
give me just a couple of minutes.
1 minute.
Okay. Fair enough. Genocide, we have not found any master grave yet. We have not found, toxicologically, we have not found any pregnant woman coming out of there. There is no genocide. No country declared genocide except the United States. Even the British, they have not declared a genocide. The UN, they say it's not a genocide. Not even the US allies, they say it's a genocide. And if to call it a genocide by the State Department, Secretary Powell, he say they made a 1,200 interview in refugee camp in Chad, and what they have described to them is a genocide. The State Department investigation, they never put a foot inside of Darfur to verify that. It's not a genocide.
Okay.
Because there is some of these tribes that are fighting within the government troops. Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
My name is Khalid Musa from Embassy of Sudan. My question is to Mr. Saleh Bouker. Number one is, to what extent do you believe that is the split and disunity within the rebel group in Darfur is an obstacle for peace in Darfur, number one? Number two, are you more SPLM than Salva Kiir himself when you stated that the southern government of Sudan did receive the revenues of oil since just a couple of days ago after a presidential meeting said that and stated that clearly to the media that the government of Southern Sudan had fully received the revenues of oil to that particular time. So from where did you get that information? And number three is in your presentation you always refer, you said government of Sudan, referring to one element in the government, since the government consists and composed of 14 political parties, including the National Congress Party and the SPLM. And as if you are not recognizing the government of national unity as a natural production of CPA. So, and do you believe on the collective responsibility of the government as a whole to administer to run the country and to solve the crisis, since you didn't refer at all to the partner that is share the power with the National Congress Party? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lawrence Freeman with Executive Intelligence Review Magazine. The question I have is in terms of the premises of the discussion, there seems to be I find in these discussions a fair amount of arrogance by the West in how they view the African countries. And I think the disregard for any notion that there might be something called sovereignty for an African nation and having certain rights and understood and respected, I think shows up all the time in discussions of who says who has a right to be the government of Sudan and who doesn't, and these groups have a right to separate from Sudan. And you see the constant idea of actually dismembering African nations from the West. And the sovereignty question was brought out during the period where there was massive accusations of slavery until it was exposed in the Post and other papers that this was a manipulation to some extent by free traders trying to make money. And people just regularly cross over the border into Sudan and brag about it without any respect for sovereignty. And I find that in Mr. Booker's comments today a little bit disingenuous. And the other area is economic development. If you look at the four, it's clear to anybody with a brain that you have to have water in this region. And there's been no attempt for long-term economic infrastructure to bring water to this area, as most areas and most conflicts in Africa are fueled by lack of economic development. And there's been nothing done to help anybody in Darfur. And then when the fight breaks out, the West jumps in and starts making its accusations. And it's completely disingenuous because it hasn't helped at all in solving the underlying economic problem. And I think these kinds of issues have to be brought up in this discussion.
Jamara?
Thank you. I'm Jamara Rohn from Human Rights Watch. I want to congratulate both the speakers. You've both been very eloquent, but I must say that Ambassador Kidder has really outdone himself because he has done well with a very bad hand. There are very few facts at his disposal, so he's put up a as good as a defense of the Sudanese government as you can do with so little facts to back up the Sudan government. The fact is that if the Sudan government were very truly welcoming of the African Union, it would be a much better partner to the African Union. It would not deny African Union troops on the ground jet fuel. It would not paint its military vehicles white to make them look like African Union vehicles. It would cooperate with the African Union. It would have given allowed the African Union to import its 105 armored personnel carriers from Canada, without months and months of delay that it put them through and so forth. So I think it's a bit disingenuous to go on this big African solution problem when the African Union, by its own statements, public statements and its own reports, has complained time and time and time again how its mission is being thwarted by the Sudanese government. The idea, I guess, that nothing is being done by anyone in Darfur to help the region, how underdeveloped it is and so forth, I'm afraid that the first responsibility there lies with the Sudanese government. And I think it's a very telling confession that there have been, from 1968 to the current time, either 13 or 30 or 60, I don't know, I keep hearing different numbers of how many conflicts. It is a long-term problem. It has not been adequately addressed by any government. And now what has really tipped the balance is that the Sudanese government has taken one side in this whole conflict, and that is the only thing that has enabled a small number of bandits, nomads, et cetera, empowered by the state and backed by planes and so forth, to gain the upper hand, although this must be temporary because of the demographics of Darfur. So I agree with the long-term political solution. The discussion, for instance, of the use of aircraft and the shielding and by the rebels and civilians and so forth is also a little disingenuous because these aircraft are not supposed to be used in Darfur according to the ceasefire. There's not supposed to be any offensive aircraft used, and so it's not responsive to talk about shielding and so forth. I agree that that it is somewhat disturbing to see the rebels so routinely endorse an international, meaning non-African or more than just African, military force. I do think it's a bit unrealistic on their part. And at the same time, the government and some of its supporters, I'm afraid, are repeating a very dangerous sort of ethnic demonization slogan, repeating in some quarters, not in all, having to do with the Zagawa and the greater Zagawa vision or agenda or something like that. We heard this in the South. It was about Dinka domination. That tends to particularly victimize one crowd, and I think the anti-Zagawa rhetoric is very, very disturbing and frightening, and it does come up even in cartoon papers. The final point, I know you're getting very nervous. I'll get on to the final point. There are many balls in the air for the Sudanese government now. One of them is cooperation, real cooperation with the international community, including with the International Criminal Court. And some people have been so bold as to say that perhaps the fear of arrest warrants that the International Criminal Court might issue in some date in the future that might involve some members of government that might be served by a UN force is actually the real motivation behind opposing a UN force and supporting an African Union force. Finally, I do accept your invitation to visit Sudan in the near future. I think it is important for us people to be able to go to Sudan, and I think it's also important for your representatives to visit college campuses and everything, but I think it's not going to be a really pleasant experience because there is a real groundswell of opinion in the U.S. on this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Peter?
You still want me? It's very late.
Go ahead.
Peter Bechtold. My name's been mentioned as a person who studied Sudan for a long time, more than 40 years, in fact. I've also worked inside the Beltway for almost 40 years, and I've come to the conclusion that in this room right now, as in all those years, there seem to be three kind of people. There are those who are representatives of organizations who naturally have to represent the views of these organizations. Then those that are students or analysts who are put in one category and they try to learn as much as possible. Then they're activists. And we've had a good representation of this. I just want to say that I haven't seen Ambassador Snyder or talked with him in a full year, but what he said is absolutely spot on, both in terms of his analysis and in terms of the recommendations that he made. One can go on and on and on. In my studies, there are more than 100 tribes in Darfur, and if a representative of each of them walked into this room one by one, and all of us who are not Sudanese were asked, what is he? Is that an Arab? Is that an African? All of us would flunk that exam because none of us would be able to tell except for a very few people. And so we need to be better students and better analysts. And this is my last comment. We all agree that there's a terrible hurt. We all agree that it must be fixed. But when you go to the dentist or any other kind of a doctor, but let's take the dentist, and the dentist pulls the wrong tooth. At the end, you still have the same toothache, but you have one less tooth with which to eat. And I'm afraid that our friends in the activist community have been guilty of that. You have to examine the problem accurately. What is the ecology? What is the demography? What is the history? And then arrive at an accurate analysis, because otherwise we'll all have less teeth, and that doesn't help anybody.
I'll let Sully be the first respondent, and he'll have to check to see how many teeth he has.
Well, very briefly, I'll try to run down and respond to a number of these. The Arab League has not played any particular active role supporting the AU mission or promoting the peace process. This domestic interest in the United States over the last more than 2 years is not related to election cycles. It is related to people's growing awareness of what's been going on in Sudan, specifically in Darfur. It is bipartisan. It's unique in many ways because it cuts across so many different communities that are part of this larger movement to end the genocide. And it is a movement, and it brings together people of different religions, people of different races, people of different political persuasions, who are all committed that, you know, when their children ask them, what were you doing when genocide was going on in Darfur, they'll have an answer. Unlike so many people during the genocide in Rwanda 11 years ago. I'm afraid the gentleman who I spoke at a panel on before simply misunderstands my point about Arab minority, African majority. I'm talking about the ruling power in Khartoum. It doesn't represent the majority of Arabs in Sudan. By that I mean people who self-identify as Arab. So I'm talking about a minority regime that represents neither the majority of Northerners nor the majority of Westerners, Easterners, or Southerners. It is a regime, and this has been a case despite changes in governments from civilian to military, where they draw on a very narrow community of ethnic groups that self-identify as being Arab. So that's the minority I'm referring to, which is why I would say the majority of people in Sudan who self-identify as being Arab do not find this government representative of them and their interests. I won't comment on the remark that genocide somehow is not occurring because no woman has been found to be pregnant. I find that insulting and egregious given the massive violence and crimes that have been committed against women and girls over the past 2 years and that continue to occur outside these camps for internally displaced people when women and girls are forced to go out looking for firewood or for food. Is the rebel split an obstacle to negotiations in Abuja? Certainly it's complicated that you have several rebel movements and you have divisions within the rebel movement. But again, the principal obstacle to negotiations is not splits within the rebel movement. It's the disinterest on the part of the government of Sudan to actually negotiate a peace agreement. The government of Sudan believes it can defeat this rebellion, which is why it has used this methodology of genocide and why it still believes it can crush the rebel organizations. And nothing short of having a force securing the region would force both sides at the negotiating table to focus on political solutions and not on the use of violence on the battlefield. In saying that Salva Kiir commented that he received oil revenues for a particular portion, for a particular period, I think the point is that the Southerners do not yet have access
to all the information that says how much oil is being pumped, what the actual revenues are. So it's sort of irrelevant until such time as Southerners have full control over their own destiny, their own resources, for them to believe that somehow generously Khartoum is offering up 50% of current oil revenues. Yes, I recognize that there is a current government of national unity, that it is not only the NIF or NCP, but also the SPLM participates as well as other parties. But I think all Sudan observers recognize that real power in the current government configuration still rests with the NCP, and that even many Southerners that have been appointed to positions of power in the current government do not represent the SPLM. I'm thinking specifically of the foreign minister, who is not accountable to the SPLM, as is obvious from the range of remarks he's been making since being appointed to that position, and as has been made clear by other SPLM officials. Thus, again, and Southerners, you could understand, are understandably preoccupied with the South and with the sovereign government in the South, and have real limited capacity to exercise power within the government of national unity, of which they are a junior partner. And they must understandably concentrate a lot of their effort and resources on developing the South, on protecting the South, toward a day when the referendum can take place. This issue of sovereignty, the gentleman from, I believe it's the LaRouche organization, suggested that somehow this challenge of sovereignty is disrespect of African countries. Not at all. When the international community gathered last September in the UN and adopted the language on the international responsibility to protect, it applies to every country, every government in the world. The point being that governments lose their rightful claim to sovereignty if, in fact, they are inflicting genocide, crimes against humanity, or war crimes against their own civilian population, and that those civilian populations have the right to expect the international community to come to their aid and protect them from their very own governments. And that is what Darfur is all about. The people need protection from their very own government. I would agree, obviously, that the government of Sudan has been placing obstacles in the way of the African Union ever since it established its first observer mission. And it continues to do so, which is why it is so eager to make sure it remains an African Union mission and not a UN mission with a larger force and a larger capability. And finally, I would say that I don't share the view that there are these divisions between organizations that have fixed organizational positions, scholars that are independently pursuing knowledge, and activists who are not examining the problem properly. Our organization, being the oldest Africa-focused organization in the United States, has always combined scholars and activists. We have pursued the truth. We have mobilized people to take and demand action. And the crimes that are going on in Darfur and elsewhere in Sudan, for that matter, are something that are motivating millions of Americans to get engaged and demand that the U.S. government take a different policy line. We're deeply concerned that the U.S. obsession with the so-called war on terror is leading the U.S. government to embrace this government in Khartoum, this desire for normalization, this desire to lift sanctions that are currently imposed on Sudan, which should be lifted on southern Sudan, but not obviously on the rest of the country, so long as the government is continuing to pursue a genocide in Darfur. And again, the U.S. government has been interested in this normalization not only for intelligence collaboration purposes, but also so that American oil companies could return to the Sudan and compete with the Chinese and others that are so heavily invested in that oil industry. I think there's a big difference between what the American public is saying that it is concerned about human rights, it is concerned about humane values, and it is concerned that a genocide that is occurring be stopped. And they want that to be the top priority. And the difference being in Washington, among the executive branch, you have many who feel the greater priority are the geostrategic objectives of sharing and gathering intelligence in collaboration with the Sudanese government. I have confidence that the American public ultimately will win out on this issue, as it has in working with Congress to get the Congress to first pass resolutions acknowledging genocide months before the executive branch was forced to acknowledge the same. And the Congress just today is marking up the Darfur Accountability Act. It is a weaker version than initially introduced by Congressman Payne, but nevertheless, it remains focused on the need for protection for the people of Darfur. Thank you.
Ambassador?
Yes. Thank you very much. A lot of issues here. We'll try to start commenting on what Mr. Saleh Boker has just said about so many things. With respect to this issue of the oil revenues, I said that the government of Southern Sudan itself issued a statement saying that they got what they have to get. And I think, period, that's the government of Southern Sudan. They admitted that they got what they were supposed to get from oil revenues. It is a very detailed thing. We are ready to send it to your organization, Mr. Boker. With respect to the issue of obstacles, being the government, and look at this, when you have a conflict which involving two parties, you just blame, saying that you do not want to, this is a moral equivalent here, but the African Union itself many times issued press releases confirming that the rebels groups used for a long time, for a long period, most of the reports coming from the African Unions as well as from the United States is placing a lot of blames on the government, especially within the last 6 months ending last October, okay? Within October, November, they blame the government here and here, intervene sometimes with Air Force. But I think last week, General Baba, the commander of the African Union troops in Sudan himself, said that the Holocaust Museum, that for the last 2 months, the rebels in Darfur are to be blamed for being obstacle for peace, for deterioration of the situation in Darfur itself. So if somebody is keen to make peace in Sudan, he should be objective, should be fair, should try to understand the situation. It is easy, of course, to deceive the American people by comparing people like myself, like my dark complexion people here as Afrikaners. If you project that to the, it's very insulting, it is very offensive. This is the biggest distortion of the situation for the situation in Sudan, and it will not lead to any resolution. You may feel very good when the U.S. Congress passed acts and resolution after resolution against Sudan. You may make the life of the people there more miserable. You may change Sudan state to a failed state. You could do that because Sudan is a very poor country. It has no constituency. There is no transnational companies doing any business in Sudan. So you have a very easy victim here. If that morally accepted, I will congratulate you on that, of course. The issue of marginalization is very interesting one. How to address marginalizations? I see marginalizations could be addressed through these paradigms of power sharing and wealth sharing and then democratization process. One man, one vote. One man, one vote. This is all. What else, I mean? How are you going to do that? We are going to have general elections in 2 years' time from now.
based on this principle of one man, one vote. And I think there is nothing better than that you could imagine. I mean, so domestic issue. Yes, it is a domestic issue now in the United States for a very wrong reasons. For a very wrong reason, because Sudan is an easy target. Freshmen at the U.S. Congress, the first issue they would grab is Sudan, because it's easy to pass resolution after resolution there, because nobody cares here. And nobody even cares about the situation. Many people think a man like mine is a white Caucasian Afrikaner. It's easy, not because it is a moral thing. I mean, Sudan is not unique. It's like so many other African countries. Is still struggling with ethnic, with religious, with so many diseases. So help them to do the right thing rather than to try to destroy the nascent nation state in Africa. With respect to the question about the helicopter, the gentleman who asked you the question about the helicopter, I would say that the helicopter grounded for a long time. I mean, the African Union and the United Nations accused during December that with respect to that place of Sharia, place called Sharia in Darfur, the government used them. But they are grounding for the last year and Antonov being removed totally from the region. With Arab League, yes, they committed themselves in their last meeting in Cairo to provide money and resources to the African Union troops. This is the latest thing that took place. And I would like also to mention that Vice President Taha met 2 days ago in Libya with the two leaders of the rebels, Dr. Khalil Ibrahim and Commander Manayar Koi. This is just 2 days in Tripoli in order to try to push the peace process ahead there. With what Mrs. Jamila Ron said about the human rights situations, and well, we've been complaining for some time about not being able to travel to Sudan. So I would say that I'm in a better position. I have more best information than you because you are not there. And I would like to declare here that I will give you a visa to go there to Sudan. And I hope that will make your imbalance report yes. Well, I hope I cover all the things. Would like to thank the Institute again and thank you all for being here. And I hope in the future we will be given a much better opportunity to express our opinion. Thank you very much.